Good afternoon. I will call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Katisa Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle, excused. Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lislegard. Representative Lucero. Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Present.
Representative Haley. I think we just heard from him, but Representative Lislegard.
Present.
Thank you. And Representative Lucero.
All right, we have a quorum. The first item of business on the agenda is approval of our minutes from before the break. Representative Katisa Watoon, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would move the minutes from March 24th.
Representative Katisa Watoon moves the minutes from March 24th, 2021. Any discussion to the motion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 24th, 2021 are approved. Well, members, I hope everyone enjoyed the break and had a chance to unplug from legislative work for at least a few hours, if not a few days. While we were on break, the work did continue on our omnibus bill, and we will take it up today and tomorrow. Our plan is today we will do a walkthrough of what is in the bill and take public testimony, and we will have time for members to ask questions. Tomorrow, we will consider any proposed amendments, and we will vote the bill out of committee. First, I will just briefly say that this bill, I think, is an excellent bill. It contains a number of very important provisions that get to the heart of what this committee's mission this session has been, to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic and represent the interests of Minnesota's consumers and small businesses, to do good consumer protection work, and to put together a good budget for the Department of Commerce. And I think that our bill accomplishes all of that. So before I turn things over to our excellent nonpartisan staff, I want to offer my most sincere gratitude to the people who did the really hard work on this bill, starting with all of the authors of the various provisions, because, of course, the omnibus bill is a collection of bills that members of this committee, both DFL and Republican, worked very hard on, and I'm very grateful for the hard work of the members of this committee and members not on this committee who contributed important provisions to this bill. I also want to thank the staff members who worked long hours to get this bill in the shape that the committee can consider it, from the CLA for the committee, Simon Brown, our researcher, Eric Anderson, our excellent nonpartisan staff, Lori Pompu and Sylvie Beckel. Also, I think Bob Eliff from House Research pitched in certain points, and Randy Chun. And, of course, our quarterback, the star of the show, our wonderful committee administrator, Addie Miller. Thank you to you all for your excellent, excellent, excellent work. And with that, I will turn the floor over to Ms. Pompu to walk through the bill.
Thank you, Chair. Chair and members, I'm going to do a pretty brief overview of the omnibus bills, and we're going to start with Article 1, which is appropriations. These are gone into in more detail in Ms. Beckel's presentation of the spreadsheet, but two items of note. that don't show up in the spreadsheet would be at the bottom of page 6 and the top of page 7. The bottom of page 6 is 1,220,000 that is canceled from this fiscal year back to the general fund for administrative costs that weren't spent by the Department of Commerce. And then on the top of page 7, we have $4,000 appropriated in this fiscal year from the Workers' Compensation Fund for insurance fraud specialist salary increases, and $97,000 in this fiscal year appropriated from the general fund to the Commission of Commerce for enforcement. And so that's Article 1. Article 2 is the Prescription Drug Affordability Act. It creates the Prescription Drug Affordability Board. We had heard this bill in committee. A change was made providing that the Commissioner of Commerce is the entity which will be establishing the board initially. On to page 17, Article 3, insurance. This includes a variety of different provisions affecting insurance. The first bill that's dealt with deals with allowing insurers to transfer, to receive credit for reinsurance ceded to an assuming insurer that's in a foreign jurisdiction. This is a model NAIC bill, and that goes on quite a while. And on to page 27, section 4 of 27 changes some of the fees that are charged to insurance companies and paid to the Department of Commerce. On page 29, this is a model NAIC Act dealing with cybersecurity events and what insurance companies are required to have in place in order to ensure that they appropriately respond to cybersecurity events. Again, we heard this in committee. And on to page 43, this was a change allowing the minimum interest amount payable on an annuity to be 0.15% instead of 1%. On to page 45, this makes a change to our Medicare kickbacks, anti-kickback statute, which allows prescription drug samples that are administered through injection or other subdermal methods to be accepted along with other types of medication as not a violation of the anti-kickback statute. On page 49, we have the timely provider credentialing language, which requires health plan companies that receive clean applications or healthcare providers credentials to approve those within a certain period of time. On to page 47, which prohibits health plan companies and medical assistants in Minnesota Care from placing an annual or lifetime limit on testing and screening for opioids. There are some repealers down at the bottom of page 47, which are more technical in nature. On to Article 4 at the top of 48, consumer protection. This contains a variety of consumer protection bills that we heard in committee. We have the first section, it relates to the student loan borrower bill of rights and how data is classified for that. The next, quite a few sections deal with changing the applicability of state restrictions on short-term consumer loans and small consumer loans so that they apply to financial organizations and industrial loan and thrift companies. And then on to page 55, and this is the bulk of the Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights. This goes on to page 64, and on page 64, we have the addition of a definition for volunteer driver, and how that cannot be used as a basis to cancel or reduce policy limits for a private passenger vehicle. We have another insertion of a definition of volunteer driver in the commercial vehicle, and definition of volunteer driver to accept it from the requirements of a transportation network company. And then we have cross-references to volunteer driver in quite a few different transportation statutes to add clarity to those. And the addition of the term volunteer driver and its definition to the medical assistance statutes as well. On page 75, we have provisions relating to catalytic converters. Ben Johnson in our office worked on this. So we have requirements related to the purchase of catalytic converter and what information has to be provided to a scrap metal dealer. And then we have the creation of a catalytic converter theft prevention pilot program and how the commissioner can effectuate that. On page 76, we have abnormal market disruptions, unconscionably excessive prices. This prohibits sellers of essential consumer goods and services from charging unconscionably excessive prices when there is an abnormal market disruption. On page 77, we have cross-references which allow the Commissioner of Commerce to coordinate with the Commissioner of the PCA and the Commissioner of Health in enforcing a variety of sections related to toxic chemicals in children's toys. And then on page 78 to 39, sorry, on page 78 to 81, we have provisions related to renters' rights in relation to self storage units, notifications they must receive, property that they can remove. And then on page 82, we have third-party food delivery fees, limitations. This is a temporary provision which places limits that third-party food delivery services can charge restaurants for food that they are delivering. And then we are on to Article 5. Article 5, collection agencies and debt buyers. This was originally in the governor's bill, House File 1031, and it adds a debt buyer to the definition of collection agencies. And then regulates it under that chapter in a similar way that collection agencies are currently regulated. A lot of these are just the insertion of the term debt buyer and making cross-reference changes. On page 92, we have garnishment prohibition on COVID-19 government assistance, which prohibits garnishment on federal, state, local, and tribal government payments made to relieve issues related to COVID-19. And then we're on to Article 6, miscellaneous. Starting in Article 6, we have changes made to appraiser internet pre-license courses and continuing education courses. These are more technical in nature. On page 94, we have exceptions for when a professional course instructor can display logos or branding and when those aren't violations of Department of Commerce policies. This article also includes the Department of Commerce's technical bill. So quite a few of the next sections are just clarifying rewrites and clarifying changes. On page 96, we have a change to the gold bullion dealers surety bond requirements and when they must notify the Commissioner of Commerce when a representative is terminated. We have changes to licensing fees, technical changes, all the way to page 100, where we add definitions to the real estate appraisers chapters. We had a definition of evaluation. We had a definition of interagency appraisal and evaluation guidelines. There on page 101 at the bottom, we begin a dis- the section on the valuation bias course, and that those receiving a license under this chapter have to complete it within 2 years of receiving their license. On page 102, we also deal with abandoned underground petroleum storage tanks. There's an explanation of what to do if something, if a storage tank is taken out of service and is located on property that is held in trust for local taxing districts, and what would be charged to someone if they wanted to repurchase that property and that removal process had begun. We remove a sunset, and then on page 103, we start a discussion of electric cooperatives and how they may use existing easements and work with broadband companies to install broadband transmission lines or provide broadband service, what rights property owners have in relation to this, how they would deal with claims for damages. And then we are on to page 106, technical changes. One change here that requires a sales lead generator to provide certain disclosures. On page 107, there's a temporary provision regarding the approval of appraiser internet courses by the Commissioner of Commerce. Page 107, we also have the Minnesota Council on Economic Education. They currently receive $300,000 in the appropriation section for grants, and this section lays out what they're to do with those grants and what services they're to provide. On to page 108, Consumer Debt Collection Language Barrier Working Group requires the Commissioner of Commerce to establish the working group, lays out membership, lays out what has to be in the report that the Commissioner of Commerce will provide. And then we're on to collection agency employees working from home with the temporary provision, which allows collection agency employees to work outside of their licensee's place of business. And then we have some repealers at the end. And that is our omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Ms. Papu. Next, we will have Sylvia Beckel, our fiscal analyst, walk through the finance aspect of the bill. Ms. Beckel.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to share my screen, so one moment, please. Okay, so you should be able to see my Commerce Finance spreadsheet. I am just showing the House position. I have another spreadsheet that you likely saw on the website that contained fiscal years 18, 19, 20, and 21, and then also the base and governor positions. But given we're presenting it this way, I thought it would be best to just show the House. But if you have any questions about the full spreadsheet, I'm happy to answer those as well. So most of the appropriations that are in this bill are to the Department of Commerce. Where they are not, I have done my best to highlight them, and I will do my best to mention that as we go through. So the total appropriations to Commerce for fiscal years 22-23 are here. I also have included columns for fiscal year 21 and the change from base from fiscal year 21 because of a few provisions that are in this bill concerning this year. Here I show the revenue from the general fund. If there are other items that have revenue, those are shown later in the spreadsheet. And I've done my best to highlight when items are governor's proposals or House proposals. And so here's the revenue and then the total general fund impact, line 6 plus line 15 is here. So moving on to the separate divisions of Commerce. The Financial Institutions Division has some operating increases per the governor's request. And this also has the Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights section. So that receives $254,000 each year. The Administrative Services Division, here you can see the administrative holdback. When the November forecast came out, the governor asked agencies to look for any funds that could cancel. And so that is this. The House position is holding that as well. And then you can just see some other operating increases here. The telecommunications division has its general fund operating. There is a small operating increase. And then you can also see the direct Telecommunications Access Minnesota, or TAM, fund appropriations. The transfer to the LCC for captioning legislative coverage has received an increase for fiscal years 22 and 23, and then a smaller increase for fiscal years 24 and 25 for legislative captioning. Otherwise, the money has remained the same. I apologize if my cursor is rather shaky. My internet seems to be struggling. Down to the enforcement division. Here again, we see some operating increases. We also see some operating specifically for insurance fraud specialists from House File 401, healthcare enforcement costs. Here is the appropriation from the general fund for the Minnesota Council on Economic Education. That is $300 in fiscal year 22 only. Then here is the Governor Securities Unit relocation. You may have seen that up on in the financial institutions area as well, seemingly a large appropriation. Really, it's just moving one agency to here from here. Or one agency, I apologize, one office, so the securities unit relocation. Then we have the House catalytic converter theft prevention provision, and that receives $190,000 in fiscal year 22, and then it has a base of 92 each year in the tails. The workers' compensation fund also received a bit of an operating increase per House File 401. And the auto theft prevention account is receiving $200,000 in fiscal year 2022 from the auto theft prevention account in the special revenue fund. Here you see the actual transfer from the consumer education account to the general fund for the Minnesota Council on Economic Education. So transfer from the special revenue to general fund, and then up here is the general fund appropriation. Then we have the insurance division. Again, some operating increases, increases for health insurance rate review. And then we have the prescription drug affordability board items. Again, here's an item that is not to Commerce, it's to the Attorney General's office. But so Commerce will receive $197,000 in fiscal year 2022 and $358,000 in fiscal year 2023, and that is ongoing. The Attorney General's office receives $456,000 in fiscal year 2023, and that is also ongoing. Then, the insurance division also has items from the workers' compensation fund. And I also just show a change from the November 2020 forecast here, just to let you know that it has increased. And this is something they have the purview to do, just those small increases from the workers' compensation fund. And finally, we have the weights and measures division, which as you can see is empty here. The governor had requested additional funding for equipment and increases, but this is not in the House position. And I am available to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel. We will now take public testimony on the bill, and then we will have time for member discussion and questions. The first testifier is Peter Brickwitty. Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, thank you to you and members. For the record, my name is Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Commerce. Commissioner Arnold is testifying in another committee that at this moment is hearing the other half of the agency's budget, so she sends her regards and regrets due to the scheduling conflict. I'd like to thank the committee staff and echo your thanks at the top of the meeting, Mr. Chair, to Ms. Miller, Mr. Brown, Ms. Pompeo, and the other members of the House Research staff who worked on the bill, and Ms. Beckel for her work as well. And I'd like to express the department's gratitude to the whole committee for the bill, which includes so many of the priorities that were contained in the governor's budget for our agency. As Commissioner Arnold has presented to the committee previously, the current funding levels in several areas of the department are not sustainable. We appreciate the level of consideration given in the bill, which will help us prevent and in many cases improve service levels at Commerce. I want to specifically thank you for including the department's proposals to fix the structural budget problem in the insurance division and for the inclusion of the governor's recommendation to add resources in the securities unit. I'd also like to thank you for including a number of the department's policy priorities, which have passed out of committee earlier this year on a bipartisan basis, including the NAIC model acts the agency has worked on throughout the session and the department's technical bills. There are also several strong consumer protection proposals that are included, as you heard in the walkthrough, and we look forward to continuing to working with you on those. One item from the governor's budget that was not included, and Ms. Beckel just touched on it at the end of her presentation, that I do want to draw members' attention to, is a critical need in the department's weights and measures unit. The COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated what was, prior to the pandemic, a slowly emerging problem, and has created a significant funding shortfall for weights and measures. The revenue from the petroleum inspection fee, which funds the weights and measures unit, is down 15% year-to-date compared to last year, and this has created another structural deficit for this well-respected unit, which, as members know, ensures that grocery scales and gas pumps are working accurately for consumers and businesses, amongst many other precision commercial devices across the entire state. Without additional funding to fix this growing problem, Commerce will be looking at fairly drastic cuts for this unit. Aside from that, that issue, which we look forward to working on with you, Mr. Chair, and members on this, on that issue as the bill moves forward, I'm happy to answer questions, and thank you again for your time and your work.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwoody. Before we get to the rest of the testifiers, I neglected to mention at the outset that I'm asking all members members of the public who are testifying to limit their remarks to 3 minutes. Mr. Brickwoody did that even without my prompting, and I hope others will follow his example. The next testifier is Anna Boroff from the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. Ms. Boroff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Anna Boroff, and I am the executive director of Minnesota Cable, which is made up of broadband providers, many of them rural, across the state. And I did time my testimony. It's under 3 minutes. My testimony is in reference to the language in the delete all starting on line 103.22 regarding electric co-ops and their intent to use private easements beyond their original purpose. This language would allow cooperatives to use these easements beyond their original purpose and anyone they contract with as well. It sets up an eminent domain-like process in order for the cooperatives to use the private property that they currently utilize for electric service for this additional purpose. Expanding access to rural broadband is something many broadband providers are working hard on. Many of my members are using private capital, state broadband grants, federal funds to deploy to unserved areas as quickly as possible. And so if the legislature is willing to grant additional access to private easements using a special eminent domain-like process to the electric co-ops, Minnesota Cable believes this should be granted to all broadband providers. However, Minnesota Cable believes that the bill violates established eminent domain law in Minnesota, and we raised these constitutional issues at the last committee hearing. Since I know our time is limited, we have provided a decision tree chart to the committee as a visual, and I saw that that was posted on the committee website, and I appreciate that. These issues should be debated and discussed in the House Judiciary Committee. The bill was laid over and never made that important committee stop. There may be a way to come up with a constitutional way for all broadband providers to use existing easements with an expedited process, but that will require additional work and for all stakeholders to be willing to change the bill. We have expressed our willingness to work on the bill. There have not been discussions on the House side regarding the bill since it was heard in this committee that I am aware of. We did meet with the Senate author and REA before the break. Unfortunately, the bill's constitutional flaws have not been addressed, nor has the bill's unlevel playing field that the bill would create in favor of one set of providers have been addressed. Co-ops already have a leg up on other providers due to their ownership and control of utility poles and their ability to charge competitors unreasonable rates for the use of those poles. The proposed language in this bill is not needed for cooperatives to move forward in deploying rural broadband. Electric co-ops can and already are offering broadband services today. Right now, just like every other broadband provider, co-ops must negotiate or renegotiate these private easement agreements with landowners. For example, just one of my members has over 6,000 private easements. Should they need to change any of them, they must go back to the landowner for permission. While this does take time, it does avoid takings issues, and it does not restrict the rights of landowners as this bill proposes. Minnesota Cable remains opposed to this section. If you have any questions, either myself or our counsel to the association is also on the line to answer them. And so thank you so much for your and the committee's time.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Joyce Pepin from the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Ms. Pepin.
All right. Can you hear me okay? Well, thank you, Mr. Okay. Chair. Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Joyce Pepin, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs and General Counsel for the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. And I want to thank you for including the broadband language in the omnibus bill beginning on page 103. It's a very important piece of legislation, and I really appreciate the opportunity to testify today. As you all know, COVID-19 has created many challenges in Minnesota, including forcing schools and businesses to figure out how to conduct operations on virtual platforms. This has been difficult on many fronts, particularly in remote areas of the state that don't have access to high-speed internet, but co-ops can help in this situation. As you may know, in the 1930s, our state's nonprofit electric cooperatives brought electric service to rural Minnesota in very rural areas of the state where for-profit utilities would not go. And these same electric co-ops now have an opportunity to help bridge that digital divide between rural and urban areas of the state by using their existing infrastructure to enhance the availability and quality of broadband service in rural Minnesota. In fact, there are 44 distribution co-ops that serve about 1.7 million Minnesotans in all 87 counties. So they have quite a reach expanding to all four corners of the state. This legislation is needed to address legal barriers so that co-ops can take full advantage of that opportunity. The bill will help ensure that Minnesota's electric cooperatives can effectively and efficiently use their own existing electric easements to deliver high-quality fiber-based broadband to rural Minnesota. And let me repeat that again. This will allow co-ops to use their own easements that they've already obtained for the additional purpose of broadband, just like any other corporation or entity can use their own easements. 19 states have now passed legislation to address this issue in response to a Missouri lawsuit. In this state, this bill will help further the state's goal of ensuring universal access to high-speed broadband service, not just in metro areas, but in all corners of the state. And it does so in a way that fully respects the rights of landowners and local communities. And we've worked very hard with internal and external counsel to make sure that we've addressed landowners' concerns. The bill provides notice to all landowners with 6 months for objection before work can begin. It allows for an express opportunity for landowners to bring court challenges, to stop intended use or obtain damages. It includes a specific requirement to notify local communities and abide by their local right-of-way requirements. And that pretty much sums up the bill. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify and for your support, and I'm available to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Pepin. The next testifier is Ron Elwood. Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I'm here to testify on lines 78.6 through 82.12, the storage lien law provisions. These provisions represent a compromise agreement with the Self-Storage Association, and I really want to thank Mr. Joe Daugherty, Senior VP and Counsel for the SSA, and Mr. Amos Briggs of Lockridge, who is the SSA's in-state advocate. Their cooperation and collaboration in reaching this agreement is most appreciated, and we have included things that advance the interests of both consumers and facility owners. I also want to thank Representative Egbaje, the author of the underlying bill, House File 1205, for carrying the bill and working so hard to achieve this agreement. The provisions do four things. They consolidate the notice of sale provisions that are spread over three sections of the storage lien law into one. They update the dollar amounts for the value of clothing and tools of the trade to which certain occupants have, even if they are denied, access to their units due to a delinquency. This amount has not been changed since 1988. The amendment here also narrows the ability to access these critical possessions only to those who can demonstrate that they are receiving some kind of public assistance or are survivors of domestic violence or sexual assault. Third, the bill clarifies the nature, the description of the goods that will be auctioned off. And fourth, it takes the existing expedited remedy for ejectment out of 504B, where it is ill-placed, and properly places it within the storage lien law. The nature of the relationship between the storage facility owner and the storage unit occupant is different between that of a landlord and a tenant. It is not a residential landlord-tenant relationship. And under this change, the storage facility owner who needs to urgently remove an occupant retains all the expedited timeframes that they have under current law. I'm happy to answer any questions. And thank you again, Mr. Chair, for including these provisions in the Omnibus Commerce Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. The next testifier is Joe Doherty of the Self-Storage Association. Mr. Doherty.
Thank you, Chairman Stevenson and members of the committee. I largely echo Mr. Elwood's testimony, especially as it relates to the substance of the bill, but I'll be very brief. Again, for the record, my name is Joe Doherty. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota Self-Storage Association. And as Mr. Elwood had mentioned, following introduction of House File 1205, we had several productive conversations with Representative Agbaje, Mr. Elwood, you, Chair Stevenson, and discussed the bill with many of our self-storage members in Minnesota. Those conversations and discussions led to the language that now appears in sections 35 through 40 of the Omnibus Bill. I am pleased to testify in support of those sections, and I am grateful particularly to Representative Agbaje, Mr. Elwood, for working with us to craft a resolution that balances consumer rights in the interests of self-storage businesses in Minnesota. With that, I will conclude and thank you for consideration of my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And I will take the chair's liberty to say to both Mr. Elwood and Mr. Doherty that your work on this bill is just an example of what the Commerce Committee is all about, where stakeholders came together and found an agreement and got that mythical peace in the valley. So thank you to you both for your extremely hard work on that provision. The next testifier is Alexi Madden. Ms. Madden.
Yes, hello, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Alexi Madden, and I'm here on behalf of DoorDash, a third-party delivery platform. Thank you for having me here today. We respectfully oppose Article 4, Section 41, regarding third-party delivery fees on page 82. We ask it be stricken from the bill. The last time this language was heard by the committee, it was in House File 299, where the bill passed. After the hearing, we continued to work with the sponsor to ensure that the language worked for all parties involved. However, shortly after it was transmitted to the Judiciary Committee, those conversations unfortunately stalled. As you may know, House File 299 was then never heard in the Judiciary Committee, and concerns with the enforcement provisions still remain. You may remember from the last hearing that several third-party delivery platforms spoke to the many things that we've done for the restaurant industry during this extremely challenging time. Among many other things, DoorDash voluntarily capped their own commissions between March and May of 2020 during the hardest portion of the pandemic when no one really knew what was going on, and additionally provided $8 million in relief grants for restaurants across the country, including $150,000 to restaurants in St. Paul and $150,000 to restaurants in Rochester. At that hearing, we also spoke to the cost of delivery and the many benefits merchants receive by being on our platform. Among other things, merchant commissions pay for delivery driver pay, driver insurance, marketing and advertising on the platform, credit card fees, background checks, and customer service representatives for all three of our users, merchants, drivers, and customers. Drivers are directly impacted by commission caps. The national average wage of a Dasher is $22 an hour while active on the platform. That's pretty good wage considering that typically it's used as supplemental income, and you know, typically urban areas are also a higher cost of living as well. I'd also like to point out that in your hearing packets, you should have received a report from the Progressive Policy Institute that also denotes other negative impacts of commission caps in case you needed some additional light reading at this time. While we understand the original intent of this bill was to help restaurants during a difficult time, I would note that Minnesota is back to 75% indoor dining and several aid programs have been released in the interim. The recently passed Restaurants Act that was part of President Biden's $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan included $26.8 billion in restaurant aid through the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. That fund passes through the Small Business Administration, and restaurants can receive up to $5 million per restaurant or $10 million per restaurant group. We would encourage all restaurants to go and apply for those administrative grants. In the interest of time, I'm going to stop here, but happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Jeremy Estenson of the Scrap Metal Dealers Association. Mr. Estenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Jeremy Estenson. I work for the Stinson Law Firm, and I represent, as the chairman said, the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, otherwise known as ISRI. The industry is proud of the work that they've done over the last decade or so with law enforcement to help track down and prosecute criminals engaged in this theft of scrap metal. And the metal that has been most stolen has really depended upon market prices. And in the last few years, market prices haven't really been such that criminals were willing to take the risk. Well, along comes 2019 into 2020, and catalytic converter theft is on the rise. Inside of each catalytic converter are generally three relatively rare metals that are worth quite a bit of money. And as a function of how much metal is in a catalytic converter, the location of the catalytic converter on the car, and a few other factors, criminals select their targets on a, frankly, an ROI ROI basis. For instance, a Toyota Prius is an easy target because the catalytic converter is very easy to get at. The challenge, and the reason we're here in front of you today, is that catalytic converters are very tough to identify. We had the chairman out to a scrap metal recycler not that long ago, and we looked at a giant bin full of catalytic converters. They all look incredibly unremarkable, these gray tubes that even an expert might be able to tell you a range of models that it could go on, but they aren't serialized or marked or in any way indicative of the vehicle that they come off, certainly not the exact vehicle associated with a VIN number. So in working with the ISRI group and the International Association of Auto Theft Investigators, who had been putting together a list of best practices, we engaged with the insurance folks, law enforcement, the auto dealers, and others to come up with a pilot program on page 75 that would help people with the high target vehicle, the four or five models that are highly targeted, get a free opportunity to go in and have their vehicle catalytic converter serialized and potentially painted with a theft deterrent paint or a number of other things that the department may come up with. We know we have some more work to do on the language on 75.9 to 75.19, but law enforcement, industry share objectives to define, you know, other things like who can possess a detached catalytic converter and under what conditions. Who can purchase the catalytic converters and what conditions? You know, what does retiring of a detached catalytic converter look like exactly? As it stands now, if you were to come into a scrap theft dealer to sell something, your face, your car, the material you're selling are all recorded digitally via a high-definition camera, and you sign an affidavit. Well, there's probably some other things that we need to capture in the retiring of a catalytic converter, but those discussions are ongoing, and the chair has our commitment, as do Representative Richardson, Davids, and Juergens, to find a suitable compromise before this bill is on the governor's desk. Mr. Chair, happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Estenson, and as I said with the prior testifiers, I also want to commend you for working in the spirit of the Commerce Committee to find a compromise here, and I appreciate the discussions that we've had and will continue to have. The next testifier is Paul Cassidy from Payday America. Mr. Cassidy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members. My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the Stinson Law Firm of Minneapolis. I'm here today to speak in opposition to the legislation before you on behalf of our client, Payday America. Specifically, we are opposed to the 36% annual percentage rate on short-term loans contained in Article 4. The rate is simply not economically sustainable for our client or for the industry. It's 36% annual percentage rate on a $350 14-day loan would basically allow us to charge a fee of less than $5 for that loan, which doesn't even begin to cover our costs to make that loan. Under current law, we basically charge $35 for that same $350 14-day loan. Payday America operates 12 locations throughout Minnesota, employing over 100 team members, and provides loans to thousands of Minnesotans. In addition to the negative impacts on our employees, this bill will effectively eliminate over $100 million in short-term credit currently available to Minnesotans. The legislation will have the complete opposite effect of what supporters of this legislation intend. This legislation will force individuals into worse options when they need a short-term credit resource. By limiting their choices, you drive them to the higher cost, unregulated lenders on the internet and otherwhere and elsewhere, who use less than ethical debt collection practices and for whom you as a regulator have no control over. We are unaware of any material complaints from Minnesota consumers involving our loans, loans written by other regulated consumer loan and payday loan lenders and regulated by the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Minnesota's regulated short-term consumer loan industry is a safe, reasonable, and responsible place for consumers seeking financial products. Putting us out of business or restricting customers' access to credit doesn't reduce the demand to address a short-term financial need. Current law was written with a few thoughts in mind. Without regulation, the business of short-term lending would go underground and individuals would be taken advantage of, and people would turn elsewhere where transactions are either unregulated or where fees and interest rates are significantly higher. Members, please take the time to view this issue in the context of what is really happening on the ground right here in Minnesota. We have a safe, responsible, and reasonable regulated small consumer loan industry in our state that takes care of its customers. And finally, I'll remind you of something I think I've testified to in the past and ask you to consider the question. Do you think it's reasonable and fair to charge someone $35 for the privilege of taking out a $350 14-day loan? This is at the heart of this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you. The next testifier is Ryan Hamilton from the Catholic Conference. Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ryan Hamilton. I'm here to come before you on behalf of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. MCC is part of a broad coalition of nonpartisan entities that are urging legislators to implement morally acceptable payday lending standards in Minnesota. I'm here to encourage the support for the reform provisions that have been included in this omnibus bill, specifically Article 4, Sections 2, 3, 4, 5, Sections 9, and 10. We have no political or profit motive attached to our work on this issue. If anything, our agenda is to make sure that there's one less pitfall in the marketplace for families who are living paycheck to paycheck. Simply put, MCC and our partners are encouraging the legislature to implement common sense solutions. The mere presence of a willing lender and a willing consumer does not make for a good bargain, especially when that lender's business model is based on practices that amount to modern day usury. I know that's a strong word, but you know, we have quotes from Mr. Michael Donovan, the former district director of operations for Check and Go, a national payday lender. And he disclosed, and I quote, they trained company salespeople to keep customers dependent and make sure they keep reborrowing forever if possible. And that quote is from an article in the Columbus Dispatch on September 13, 2007. So what we're dealing with is the only lending industry in America that doesn't evaluate their borrowers' ability to pay. And actually, they rely on the fact that they won't and can't pay. Default is, in fact, their very business model. And that's just the epitome of responsible lending and usury. This legislation we're asking for isn't some radical anti-business proposal. The 36% cap was drawn from the Military Lending Act. And in its report to Congress urging the original passage of the Military Lending Act, the Department of Defense characterized payday lending loans as predatory loans. So our society has already made a public policy decision that our active duty heroes and protectors should not be subject to exploitation when they are under financial duress. What our coalition is simply asking for is that common sense policy be expanded to all Americans. The argument that a 36% cap will put petty lenders out of business and leave poor families without a lending option, I'm sorry, it's simply a canard. You know, the truth is there are other options. There are nonprofits. There are workouts with their lenders. There are other options. It should also be noted that over a dozen states have implemented the cap that we're proposing, and the sky hasn't fallen. So we thank the chair and members of the committee for including these important reforms in the omnibus bill, and we invite all members of the committee on both sides of the aisle, the legislature as a whole, to seize this opportunity to stand up for working families and promote a marketplace that fosters upward mobility rather than exploitation. Thank you all for your service to the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. The next testifier is Sarah Nelson-Pallmeyer from Exodus Lending. Ms. Nelson-Pallmeyer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and representatives. Again, my name is Sarah Nelson-Pallmeyer, and I serve as the executive director of Exodus Lending, a statewide nonprofit that exists to relieve Minnesotans from financial stress caused by payday lenders. I was happy to testify to this committee on January 27th on behalf of these Minnesotans and pleased to do so again. I'm speaking in support of Article 4, Sections 3 to 6 in the omnibus bill before you today. Exodus Lending was founded as a response to the hardships faced by persons who have taken out small dollar loans from places like Ace Cash and Payday America. Exodus Lending refinances these loans, charging neither interest nor fees, and we allow persons a year or more to pay off those loans, not the 2 weeks that the payday lenders will charge. Our program has served nearly 500 Minnesotans from 36 counties throughout the state. We've lent $388,000 and estimate that we've saved participants in total over $1 million in interest and fee payments. As Mr. Hamilton said, currently 18 states plus the District of Columbia.
It appears we have lost Ms. Nelson-Pallmeyer, so we will move to the next testifier and give her a chance to finish up her testimony if we're able to reestablish a connection. The next testifier is Sherry Munyon from the Volunteer Driver Coalition. Ms. Munyon. Okay. We'll try another one. We'll try Peter Fjellsted of Pharma. Mr. Fjellsted.
Thanks, Chair Stevenson. Can you hear me okay? There's some thunderstorms going on.
I can hear you, yes.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Peter Fjellsted, Senior Director of State Policy at Pharma, Trade Association of 33 biopharmaceutical manufacturers that make brand name medicines that save and improve lives every day. Today, I respectfully oppose the Prescription Drug Affordability Board language contained in the Delete Everything Amendment to House File 1031, also known as the House Omnibus Commerce Bill. This is the language from House File 801, as previously heard in committee, and it begins under Article 2 of the Delete Everything Amendment. We oppose this language because it would impose it. We oppose this language because it imposes a harmful price control through an upper payment limit, which could restrict patient access to their medicines and discourage research and development of new treatments and cures. Second, it fails to consider the real problem of getting the cost of prescription drugs under control. That is primarily due to health plan benefit design. Third, it doesn't take into account the fact that the growth rate in prescription drug costs has slowed in recent years. And in fact, prescription drug medicines account for only about 3% of the total Medicaid budget in Minnesota, for the most recent figures available. Additionally, retail prescription drug medicines prices for brand name drugs grew at just 1.7% on average in 2019, which is below the rate of inflation for the third year in a row. Moreover, 90% of the medicines consumed in the United States are generics, which often cost pennies on the dollar. Those instances where drugs are exorbitant in costs are often outliers. Fourth, this language does not recognize that price controls on brand medicines raise significant legal concerns. Fifth, it raises additional legal concerns under both the federal and state law related to potential disclosure of trade secret information, particularly by allowing the affordability board created by the bill to determine what information qualifies as proprietary. Sixth, It would establish a new level of bureaucracy on top of last year's prescription drug price transparency bill, which doesn't begin collecting the designated information from manufacturers until October of 2021, about 6 months from now for report due to the legislature next January. Two more points. Seventh, it may harm Minnesota's economy during this ongoing pandemic and our recovery from a recession. Lastly, in other states where affordability boards have been established, they have not conducted any business to drive down the cost of prescription drugs for the consumer. In fact, Maryland was one of the first states to do so, to enact an affordability board, as it does nothing of note since it's been in existence for the last few years. They've all mostly held organizational meetings. I'd like to direct anybody to a handout that I submitted to the committee, the Medicine Assistance Tool, 950 programs from manufacturers to help patients afford their prescription drugs. And in the end, I'd just like to say that we respectfully oppose the bill, Chair Stevenson, and I'm open to any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next testifier is Stephanie Stern from the MS Society. Ms. Stern.
Hello, I am Stephanie Stern. I'm Associate Vice President of Advocacy and Policy for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, and I am also personally affected by MS. My mom has lived with MS for 40 years. I live here in Minneapolis, but my mom and dad live in Ortonville, Minnesota. On behalf of the National MS Society, we are pleased to share our support for the provisions of HF 801, which would establish the Prescription Drug Affordability Board. MS, for those of you who don't know, is an unpredictable and often disabling disease of the central nervous system. The symptoms vary a lot from person to person, but they can range from numbness and tingling to blindness and paralysis. And there's no cure for MS, but the availability of MS disease-modifying therapies, or DMTs, has completely transformed the treatment of MS over the last 25 years. When my mom was diagnosed, there was not a single medication she could take, but now there are more than 20 DMTs on the market, and all the evidence shows that if you get on and stay on one of these DMTs, that's the best way to manage the course of your disease and prevent worsening disability or damage from MS. But unfortunately for people with MS, the price of the treatments has gone up dramatically since the first DMT was introduced in 1993. That first medication was so anxiously awaited for. It came on the market at $11,500. And today the price of that same medication has risen by almost $100,000. In the MS medications market, price increases occurring once or twice a year are happening with almost all of the medications. In 2020, the most recent year we have data, the median price for brand MS medications was around $92,000 a year. These high prices have real life consequences for people who have a chronic condition in the form of high out-of-pocket costs and the burden of having to fight for copay assistance to afford your meds. In a recent survey of people with MS conducted by our organization, 40% of people with MS shared they've had to go off of their medication or alter the use of it due to cost. And I will tell you that my mom is among those who have had to stop or delay. She's had to delay her treatment due to cost and waiting for copay assistance to come through. And that's happened multiple times, and every time it's such a scary roll of the dice. We believe the Affordability Board has the potential to address price increases for the existing MS medications. This would be an independent and nonpartisan body advised by community stakeholders. They would review prescription drug prices. The process is intended to be transparent and deliberative and give stakeholders an opportunity to comment. And we have, we believe this could help ensure greater accountability for price increases in the state of Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I thank you for your attention to this important and complicated issue.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Kenza Haj Musa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kenza Haj Musa. I'm the Public Affairs Director of Take Action Minnesota. We're a statewide multiracial member organization. We strongly support Article 2, establishing the Prescription Drug Affordability Board. We're also very happy to see that the reinsurance program was not included in this bill. Take Action has worked on healthcare issues for the last 15 years. About 2 years ago, our members told us that we need to focus on prescription drug costs. We support the Prescription Drug Affordability Board because we believe that every person deserves the chance to live a good, healthy life. We believe that our government has the responsibility to make healthcare work for everyone and has the authority to make medicine affordable. Right now, we're all paying the price of extremely high drug costs. We're paying in our health insurance premiums. We're paying the public health toll when our community members can't afford the medicine they need. And people are paying for it with their lives and livelihoods. Across the state, we've heard worries and horror stories from our members. We heard from Catherine, whose brother-in-law died rationing insulin alone at home. We heard from Cassandra, who chooses to, between paying rent or taking her medicine each month. She's figured out how to ration her pills so that she doesn't go into crippling withdrawal when she skips her medicine. We heard from Glenn, a graduate student whose entire life fell apart when they had to go off their bipolar 2 medicine because they couldn't pay $700 per month for medicine. We heard from Kate, a mother who's had to choose which one of her sons with life-threatening allergies would get an EpiPen because their family couldn't afford $1,500 per month for all three of them to have one. That's a medicine that's been around for 35 years. We heard from Phil, a college student diagnosed with Crohn's disease. His family hit their $5,000 deductible for prescription drugs the second week of January this year. We heard from Aaron, whose treatment for narcolepsy cost $192,000 per year. This is a rare disease and a medicine that was developed through public tax dollars. But Minnesotans are going bankrupt and losing their lives and health for medicine that's 100 years old, for medicine that's affordable in other countries like Canada, and for medicine that was developed through our publicly funded research and tax dollars. It's not fair, but the good news is that the rules were written this way and we can change them. This board is one of the best tools that we have for making a difference in changing the rules. It was the number one recommendation of the Attorney General's Task Force on Lowering Pharmaceutical Drug Costs. That report came out in 2020. We know that drugs don't work if people can't afford them, and we urge you to vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you. I am told that we have Ms. Nelson-Pallmeyer back. Ms. Nelson-Pallmeyer, sorry about the technical difficulties. I think the last we heard from you was with about 18 other states. So if that gives you some sense of where you were when you cut out.
Yes, thank you so much. My internet froze at the very worst time. So I'll try to make it quick so it won't stop again. So yes, currently 18 other states, including just Illinois, passed an interest rate cap of 36% just this spring. And since 2006, through the Military Lending Act, payday lenders have been restricted from charging higher than 36% APR on small dollar loans to active duty military throughout the country, including here in Minnesota. So contrary to what you may hear from the payday lending industry, the Center for Responsible Lending has found no evidence to show that states with interest rate caps have consumers rushing to get loans online. You may hear that other fees are more expensive than payday lender fees. That doesn't make them affordable. You may hear that from lenders that there are no alternatives to their products except those of a predatory nature. That is also not the case. The Bank of America, for example, offers a short-term loan called Balance Assist, which allows customers to borrow up to $500 for a $5 flat fee. Other companies and banks, credit unions will find this to be a market for business that is fair and still earns a profit. Polling just last year showed that 70% of Minnesotans support a 36% interest rate cap on payday loans, and over half of those who oppose that cap do so because they believe 36% is too high. Payday lenders may tell you that calculating an annual percentage rate or APR unfairly skews the data because the loan is only for 2 weeks. What they won't tell you is that most Minnesotans take out multiple loans before being able to pay off their loan. In Minnesota, the typical borrower rolls over their loan 7 times before paying it off. Therefore, that $35 cost per $350 loan actually becomes $245. So please join 18 other states and stop the debt trap in Minnesota by supporting Article 4, Sections 3 to 6 of this omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. And then our last testifier, I understand Ms. Munyon has also gotten back on the call. So Ms. Munyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sherry Munyon, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Public Transit Association and the Volunteer Driver Coalition. Together, they represent about 120 organizations. Our collective thank you for the inclusion of the volunteer driver definition in the omnibus bill. Volunteer drivers contribute thousands of hours and use their own vehicles to provide rides in their communities. However, it is becoming increasingly difficult to recruit and retain volunteers, and one of the reasons is automobile insurance. Unfortunately, with the advent of new services by people using their own vehicles, some volunteer drivers who work with local transit systems and nonprofit organizations found themselves treated as for-hire carriers rather than people who are simply providing community members a ride. The lack of clarity in defining a volunteer driver has led to increased costs for some. Nonprofit and local government programs reported providing more than 168,000 trips annually, serving 77,000 people. This bill will help ensure that volunteers can continue to transport older adults and people with disabilities to community services across the state. Volunteer drivers are also providing a financial bargain for the state. One example is a volunteer driver who drives a passenger from Wilmer to St. Cloud and is reimbursed at the business mileage reimbursement rate. The cost for this trip is approximately $75. The same trip provided by a private for hire carrier could easily cost over $350. As the aging population continues to grow at an unprecedented pace, volunteer drivers must thrive. These volunteers will help ensure equitable access to medical care, reduce isolation, and provide safe rides. In closing, this bill is also supported by the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access, comprised of state agencies, including MnDOT, Commerce, Human Services, Board on Aging, and others. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the citizens who benefit from the volunteer driver's volunteerism. Thank you.
And thank you. And as I did with two other bills, I'll just note this is another great example of the Commerce Committee ethos is there's peace in the valley here between the Trialers Association and the Insurance Federation, which is an impressive feat, I would say. We have now concluded our public testimony, so this is a time for member discussion and questions about the bill. I will pause a minute to see if any members wish to be recognized. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and I apologize. I'm told you can't see me, and it's just a day for technical problems.
But we can hear you, and that's the important thing.
Well, that probably a mixed bag, but thank you. I just want to clarify for committee members, there was a contention by the payday lending industry that there were no complaints filed with regulators in Minnesota for that industry. As members know, that's incorrect. I would remind members of the letter from Attorney General Ellison to committee members correcting the record after the misstatements were made in the last hearing regarding the 36% rate cap. Just wanted to take this opportunity to refresh committee members' memory on that, correct the record, and then thank you, Chair Stevenson, for including that provision in this bill. It's an important provision at this time in our economy to protect consumers from exploitation by predatory lenders. So thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Dabney, for that important clarification and for authoring a very important bill. I see no other members seeking recognition, so at this time I will just remind members that we will be back at our normal time tomorrow to consider amendments and move the bill out of committee. And with that, the committee is adjourned.